Simon Russell Beale is the quintessential stage actor. He's appeared in film and on television too, of course, most recently as Falstaff in Richard Eyre's production of Henry IV Parts 1 and 2, and before that and as an illuminating guide to the symphony on BBC 4. But the theatre, and specifically the National Theatre, seems to be his home. Here he's played, amongst others, Iago, Hamlet, Benedick in Much Ado, Stalin in Collaborators, Galileo, Candide, Face in The Alchemist, and with infectious exuberance, Sir Harcourt Courtly in London Assurance. He's been seen on other stages as Macbeth at the Almeida, Leontes and Loparkin for the Bridge Project at the Old Vic and the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and more surprisingly, King Arthur in Spamalot in the West End and on Broadway. He's even appeared with the Royal Ballet in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. But playing Shakespeare at the National is where his most ardent fans hope to find him, and this season they'll not be disappointed. He's delivering a brilliant performance in an innovative production of one of Shakespeare's least known plays, Timon of Athens, a production which is part of London 2012, the World Shakespeare Festival, and the £12 Travelex season. Oh, and there's also an exhibition called Making of Timon going on alongside this in the National's foyers until October the 21st. Well, my name's Heather Neal, and Simon Russell Beale is with me now at the National Theatre to talk to Theatre Voice about Timon. It's a fascinating version of the play, isn't it? Directed by Nick Heitner, and with Ben Power as dramaturg, making some changes to the text. And the production draws clear parallels with our materialistic, cash-strapped society, but your part, Timon, is quite a strange one, a tragic person, but not in the way that Lear is. He even dies off stage, although the play might have been written somewhere around the time of Lear, mightn't it? And it falls sort of into two parts. You're a philanthropist to begin with, and then a down and out misogynist in the second half. Was that one of the difficulties, finding a unity for this character?
Philanthropist.
What did I say?
A misogynist.
Oh my goodness!
He is a misogynist as well.
But he's more misanthropist is rather more to the point, especially in this production.
He does the whole lot. Yes. That him as a tragic hero, his status as a tragic hero is an interesting one, isn't it? I can't remember, somebody wrote about it and said he just about nearly makes it as a tragic hero and then just doesn't. And as you point out, that's a large part of that is due to the fact we don't see him die on stage, which is, it's more than that, but that's indicative of something, isn't it? Symptomatic of something. He's sort of, I think it's rather moving, in fact, actually. He sort of disappears, doesn't he? He fades away. He realises that his life is, from his perspective, without meaning and without value, so he sort of just melts into the sea. And I think that's quite interesting. I did have a debate with Nick Heitner, the director, about giving him a death. Some sort of, he was going to walk through a door at the back of the stage and light was going to pour in, or I was going to go under the stage into the sea, yeah. And there'd be some sort of statement. In fact, I think in the end, Nick, sort of almost without telling me, but Nick, I think, decided that the best thing was just to literally fade away. And that's what he does. The sort of light just dims on him and he walks off stage.
Do you imagine him walking into the sea?
Yes, I do. Mm. He has one of the very few things in his life once he becomes so desperate. One of the few things that gives him comfort is the thought of the sea, and one of the few moments when his verse becomes, when his language becomes elegiac and soft, is when he imagines walking into the sea. And I think he finds that a huge comfort.
Well, what about this division, what looks like a division to the audience, but I imagine you've worked out how his character is clearly a through run.
Consistent. Yes, I mean, as a general rule of thumb, of course, this play is collaboratively written.
Yeah. Probably so, with Middleton.
So probably, I think the general rule of thumb is the first half is a lot, mostly Middleton, and the second half is mostly Shakespeare, general rule of thumb. And as you say, they are completely different worlds, they're completely different verse, they're completely different obviously psychological states of mind. So, and you have to, I suppose, embrace that and say that it is a play of two halves, like a football match. But he, as the actor playing Timon, you have to make some sort of link in your own head about what's going on to link the two. And I think I decided on a physical thing, really, first of all, which is that he didn't like to be touched. Because the thing about Timon is that he doesn't understand love, basically. I think that's the problem. He sees love merely, he sees the expression of love merely as giving things to people. He refuses to accept things from people. So it's giving, giving, giving all the time. We had a quote up on the wall of the rehearsal room by Julie Andrews about a famous philanthropist who's now in jail, actually. But it said asking so-and-so for money was like offering an alcoholic a drink. And I think that was... I found that very useful, that he just couldn't resist. He couldn't resist giving. And there's a type of innocence about that, but there's also a it's constructing of a barrier in his relationship with people. And I've said this before, that in the second half, when he can really let that idea of not being touched, not wanting to get close to people, really come to the forefront of his mind, and it's been there in the back in the first half. Doesn't want any intimacy, doesn't want any... He's one of the very few characters that doesn't have family or friends, obviously. He's absolutely alone and by himself, and that, I think, is very useful for an actor playing him. But when he gets to the second half and is at his most virulently misanthropic, he's offered love by people. And I think that's... I'd never realised that about time, and I always thought it was just simply a sort of vision of humanity that was sort of broadly thread through the whole play. And in fact, actually, that's not true. He has five encounters in the second half with people who come to see him at his worst, three of which are generous.
Well, the character of Flavius in the original here, Flavia, played by Deborah Findlay, is very loyal and sweet character who tries to help him. And yes, he just won't hear, will he?
Absolutely not. And, I mean, he gets as close as he can to saying, I think you're great and well done, but that's about it. I mean, he certainly wasn't... In our production, she offers him a lot of money for her, you know, and we're talking hundreds of pounds rather than loose change, which, I mean, he's living on the streets in the second half, so he's like the people you do see in London sleeping in doorways. So it's not loose change he offers. She offers him a lot of money for her. And in this production, he's moved by that. But he can't do anything with it. It's an odd... He can't build on that. She says, no, please come back to the real world and start again make a life for yourself. But he's gone too far down whatever road he's gone down. To regard that as a feasible option. This is the other thing about the play, is that I don't think we must necessarily assume that time is right, because again that's linked to the fact that I assume that the whole play was, everyone says, a savage attack on whatever, money-driven culture, on man's cruelty, and yes, it is, but it isn't.
Yes, Marx liked it, didn't he?
Marx's favourite play. But actually, you make a mistake, I think, in assuming that it's because Timon thinks that, or indeed that Apamantus thinks that, who's Timon's sort of closest, the truth-teller of the play. Just because they believe it doesn't necessarily mean it's true. I mean, Flavia or Flavius stands as a living example that it's not true. Or not the whole picture, anyway. So I think that's what I found exciting about doing the play, to discover that. As always with Shakespeare plays, you see, any sort of broad statement,
yes,
you know, is inevitably...
It's never that simple.
It's always nuanced in some way.
But it must be liberating to be dealing with a text that a lot of people don't know very well, and it's nobody's favourite play, so they're not going to be muttering along speeches with you. So that means
unless
that...
Unless Karl Marx was in the audience, yeah. Yes.
So that does give the director and the dramaturg and the actors some freedom with the text, doesn't it? How much has it been changed? I'm sure that, you know, Alcibiades, for instance, I thought, I'm sure he comes in and think, oh, no, I had to go back. But I mean, he's been changed quite a lot, hasn't he?
There's sort of two levels of changes. The stuff that Ben Powers did, our dramaturg, with Nick, and a little bit with me. I mean, we had a meeting with three actors and those two about a year ago and read the the script as it is in the folio, and then just discuss about what's going to be done. But basically the decisions on the large structural decisions were made by Nick and Ben. And the major one is Alcibiades, who, as you rightly say, appears in the first half in the folio edition as a sort of friend of Timon's, or at least a hanger-on of Timon's, and leaves the city in a sulk because he has a disagreement with the Senate in a scene that's been cut in our version, and then comes back to attack the city, much like the historical Alcibiades. In Nick wanted to make him into a figure of an Occupy London figure because he felt that was more more resonant than a sort of disappearing general. So those are the big decisions were made by Ben and Nick. The generalship is an interesting one because right at the end of the folio version, the Senate come to see Timon in his cave, or whatever, however you see it, and say, we really want you to come back because you're such a good general and you can come and help us defeat Alcibiades, who's now attacking the city. Well, there's been no mention of him being a general anywhere else in the play, and I think Nick felt, you know, either you import a lot of stuff or dress him up as a general, or you just do a different motive for the Senate coming to see him, which is, in our version, to come for the gold that he's, the stash of gold that he's discovered. And I think that's right. I mean, I think it's a very feeble... I mean, we know it's a first draft or second draft or whatever. It's a draft of a play.
Possibly never put on.
So we, as you imply, we're given leeway to do what we like with it, really, in a way that we can't do with a masterpiece like King Lear, for instance. But so I think he just felt that was very feeble and would require an enormous amount of rewriting to make Timon into a great general. It also slightly blurs the clarity of the moral fable, doesn't it? You know, the wonderful thing, it's like a fairy tale, you know. Man with lots of money gives it all away, left by his friends. If it's a man with lots of money who also happens to be a great general, then it all gets a little bit blurry, I think, and the play won't sustain that in a way that a great piece of work like Lear does sustain that type of ambiguity. It just doesn't work. So we got rid of Timon as a general. So logically, Alcibiades probably doesn't have to be a general. He can be something else. Well, effectively, he is a general.
Yes, but I mean, since we are clearly in London and in our time, it does make more sense to recognise the kind of people.
I don't quite know why they got rid of him in the first scenes. I mean, I think it could still have worked that Timon knows Alcibiades from before, but perhaps Nick felt that...
Because he brought the women in, didn't he?
The entertainers.
Yes.
And of course, the women he's with in the second half are actually prostitutes, but in our version, they're not. I think I don't quite know why he got rid of them in the first half, but you'd have to ask him. Mm. So anyway, those were the big decisions. And the little ones were the odd line here and there, which we needed to glue the story together.
Putting lines in, making lines up?
Yeah. Well, actually, we didn't make them up for the most part. I mean, occasionally we'd do, you know, my friends instead of my lords, you know. But actually what we did, and we were quite strict at the beginning of rehearsal, we used to take lines from other Shakespeare plays. And Nick at the beginning said, we'll try and be strict here and do them from plays of the period. And the most useful source was Coriolanus, because there's so much that's similar in terms of the environment. But by the end of it, I've got a line from Midsummer Night's Dream, and the last line of our production is actually from As You Like It, which makes me giggle. But, you know, you just thought, we literally had a sort of, you know, computer and a sort of, we'd put in, you know, dog, and out would come all these lines about dog, and then we'd pick one that we sort of liked. But at the beginning, we were quite strict, but we were less strict later.
It seems to work. So the first half, perhaps we should say something about what it looks like. And to begin with, you are in a gallery and having the Timon room named with a, you know, champagne reception, something. I think everybody sort of giggled recognition. And then you do some lavish entertaining. And then in the second half, you are down and out. You've lost all your money. The friends have not turned out to be friends after all, have not come up with any help, and so you're a homeless person living on the streets, much like people we do see, maybe not far from here.
Yes.
But then something very strange happens, and you lift a manhole cover and you find gold. Now, that does take us into another kind of world, doesn't it? Because it's been almost naturalistic up till then.
Yes, we had long discussions about the gold because I talked about it being a fable, and we've no idea where this gold comes from. And I mean, people do sit there, I think, in the audience, think, God, did he actually bury some gold? I mean, did he actually save some? Is he lying all this time? In fact, actually, the poet and the painter who come along to visit him actually think he has been lying all the time, which is interesting. So perhaps that's what puts it in the audience's head. But there's no explanation for this gold at all. He just finds gold. When Trevor Nunn did a production about 25 years ago with David Suchet, he had bank robbers burying gold, so we knew where the gold came from. Because we decided that in the end the Senate came back to Timon to ask him to come back to the city and said, would you mind bringing your gold with you? That it should be, I said, it can't be just a suitcase with 5,000 quid in it. It's got to be enough to pay off the national debt, otherwise they just wouldn't bother. So we have, and also because we've got to accept the fact that it is like magic gold. It's like elf, I used to joke it was elf gold, you know, that it's magic gold. And it's also for Timon, I talked about him being alcoholic, it is, he has a line where he says, why this, you gods, what this? I mean, of all things to find, when I'm looking for is a food and the rubbish. Yeah. I'm going to find £500 billion in gold bullion, you know.
But he could go to Tesco.
he could at least go to Tesco and get a decent meal. But it's sort of, it's just like the most horrible temptation to go down that path. Anyway, we decided in the end the only way to do it was to make it like a fairy tale. It reminded me of the scene in Winter's Tale when, you know, the old shepherd discovers Perdita and then a stash of gold. It's magic. It's part of the fairy tale. And that's the only way we could find to do it. So he does, uncover this enormous amount of gold.
Which gleams up through the...
Yeah. And at the end, and this was my idea, when he, one of his last lines is, sun, hide thy beams. And of course, Nick has set it in a very, very... it gets very dark.
Yes.
It's night time by the time he ends. So there ain't no sun to say hide thy beams too. So I said, why don't we make the gold disappear as if it was just a fantasy? So that's what I do. Sun, hide thy beams, and the gold gradually sort of melts away into nothing, which actually I quite like. But going back to the very first scenes, you mentioned the scene where the Timon room is opened in a big art gallery with a huge El Greco on the back of Christ throwing the money changers out of the temple.
Very pertinent,
but nobody's looking at it.
Yeah.
We used to joke with Nick that it was basically autobiographical the first half, because as artistic director of the National Theatre, he spends a lot of time at functions like that and at dinner parties where you have marvellous entertainment thrown on by actors of the National Theatre, amongst others, you know, and that's
in this case, the Royal Ballet.
In this case, actual genuine members of the Royal Ballet, giving us a rather lovely dance. And we used to joke that, because he was so precise about all the details of it, you know, the type of canapes, the canapes on slate, which is what canapes nowadays seem to be always presented on. The actual precise details of what the drinks were and whether you'd have champagne or whether you'd have cocktail, you know, all that stuff is absolutely what part of Nick's job is going to these sort of functions, and indeed my job up to a point. And in the very first scene we have, not only do we have politicians and as in the folio edition and lords, and in the folio edition we also have a poet, there's a poet, a painter, a jeweller and a merchant. And I said to Nick, well, there's nothing in the script as you hear it that tells us he's a merchant. Actually, I think there's one mention of trade, but I mean, it's so passing that you wouldn't be sure what he was. So I said, why don't we make him an actor? Because it's good for us to make fun of ourselves too, because we spend a lot of time begging for money, you know, and Why not? Actually, he's an American actor, which I don't quite understand. But anyway, he's an actor, which makes me laugh.
Well, I suppose one of the things the play is about is the value, or commercial value, of the arts. I mean,
yes, absolutely. I mean, and you know, people have pointed out the irony of doing it in the Travelex season when we. I mean, Nick used to do it when we started. This is about the dangers of philanthropy. you know, because we have some extremely generous donors to the arts in this country, and even more so in America. And but we are now, in this country, reliant on the mixed economy of that. And it's a substantial amount of our revenue comes from gift giving. So.
And the Cottesloe is about to have its name changed.
The Cottesloe is just about to have its name changed for the donor, which seems to me to be perfectly fair if that's what he wants.
Yeah. What about Appomattox's relationship with Timon? I mean, is he there as a truth teller, or there's no affection as such? Although Appomattox perhaps feels affection.
Yes,
for him.
I think Appomattox does feel affection for Timon. We went back and forth about our relationship, and you construct backstories, don't you, for all these characters? And I'd imagine. I was settling down on the idea of, as I say, Timon has no family. So I was settling down on the idea that he was, you know, his parents died when he was 10 or something, and he was the richest little boy in the world, you know, and surrounded by people who cared for him and looked after him and loved him indeed. You know, so his team around him are very, very loving of him. They like him. But he's in that very peculiar position of being unconscionably rich. And that I had this image that, in fact, I mean, we played around about the Appomattox and Timon don't know each other, but it became more and more productive to think they actually have known each other for years and years and years. It's almost as if they were at the same school. Mm. And Appomattox is the sort of Christopher Hitchens type character, isn't he, who is seen at these grand social functions but has a tongue that can whip.
Yeah.
And that Timon quite enjoys it. You know, quite enjoys his there's a bit where he does a mock grace as a dinner, and in our production all the people go, "Oh God, not again." And I'm going, no, it's fun. Let's listen to what you have to say. But I mean, obviously not absorbing any of the warning or the information.
Yes.
So I think there is an affection between them, and I think well, this is an affection for Appomattox for Timon. Timon is a nice guy.
Yes, you know. As you say, his servants want to look after him.
Yeah, absolutely. No, he's a nice guy. I mean, even he says, actually, I'm a nice guy at one point. He says, you know, he says, no villainous bounty yet has passed my heart. I'm not nasty. It's just I've been stupid.
Mm.
So I think Appomattox probably recognises that he's actually quite a good guy, really.
Yeah. Timon does get very angry, though, doesn't he? The second half. He's very angry with the world.
Yes, and vicious, and a lot of stuff comes out against women, as always with Shakespeare, I'm afraid, but not as always, but as often with Shakespeare. Some horrible misogyny about women, about sex. A very sexless man in the first half.
Mm.
So I think that makes a sort of psychological sense about where that comes from. It's an absolutely repressed sexual life that suddenly comes bursting forward. I think I think there's something there's some coiled spring inside him in the first half that is just waiting to be flicked by what he sees as betrayal. And he knows it's his own fault too.
Yeah.
I think that's psychologically always very, very difficult to. He never says it, but does he ever say it? I don't think he ever says, "I've been a fool." I think it's all you bastards.
Yeah.
And I think that makes a sort of psychological sense.
Yes. He assumes that he's bought them, and it turns out he hasn't.
Yes, hasn't. Yes. His bargain didn't work.
Yeah. You once, I think it's in the programme, in fact, described acting as three-dimensional literary criticism. Yeah. It's a rather brilliant sort of description. Is that because of the detail you go into in rehearsals?
No, I said it in a newspaper interview years ago, and I think what I meant, I think we were talking about my education, really, and my training, and what I learnt doing a degree in English and doing English at school with some very puritanical teachers in terms of intellectual rigour. I mean, you weren't allowed ever to say, I think this is very moving, for instance. They weren't interested in that. They were interested in absolute rigorous intellectual argument and watertight response to the script, or the script to the novel or whatever that you were studying. Yeah. And anything else was absolutely irrelevant. So what I think I was talking about that is that discipline actually been very useful because I do find myself going, well, that won't work if that happens. You know, there has to be a logical consistency. And I get rather distressed when I find that I've made a mistake that isn't logically consistent with this point out or whatever. The emotional reaction is something completely different. So when I see, say, three-dimensional literary criticism, I probably mean the first part of that process rather than... Because actually, in the end, the most important, I think, part of my job is whatever my emotional response is to something, I think, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a bleak play, but there's also quite a lot of comedy in it as well. It's partly recognition on the part of the audience, isn't it?
Yeah.
We see ourselves in our lives.
Well, there, but for the grace of God. Yeah. I mean, certainly the first half is the lives of, I suspect, a lot of people who come to the National Theatre have probably been to those parties as well.
Yeah, some of us might have been serving at them.
Yes, exactly, or performing at them. like the ballet dancers. But Nick's been very clever about, you know, the Ivy Club type of society is, that's nothing against the Ivy Club, which is a very nice place to go and have a drink, but that type of world, which is one of the scenes is set in, Westminster, obviously, the city. Yeah. I mean, and you know, so there's some cracking lines, you know, about they spoke with a corporate voice, which is actually a Shakespearean line, and it always gets a laugh.
It's amazing how many of lines are actually already in there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, he was writing Middleton. I was writing about the City of London, wasn't
yes.
he? I mean,
yes,
you just said, I shouldn't think he's changed that much in terms of psychology. That's part of the reason why Nick decided to set it in London rather than anywhere else, because there was the temptation to set it in Athens, but as I said to him, I thought that was a bit rude. Because we're not Athenians, and we've got plenty of problems here, actually, so we might as well do it in London. Yes, no, it's amazing how many of the lines still have a sort of modern punch.
The nasty dinner when he has them all round again. Yes, because he and they think, oh, it was all just some sort of mistake, and it's all right. We're back to normal, and then he serves them. I think it's stones and water in the
stones and lukewarm water. In the original.
And then
he chucks them. Well, yeah, we decided to go for shit because actually there was a practical reason, which I know doesn't sound convincing, but there was a real practical reason. He throws stones at people.
Yeah.
It's really difficult.
Dangerous.
And dangerous throwing stones at people. And if you have polystyrene stones, they sound dreadful.
Thanks.
I'm not the greatest shot in the world. In fact, I do throw a stone. It caused an immense amount of work on the prop department and met my discussion in the rehearsal room. But I do throw a stone at Appomattox in the second half, and bless them, they went and made stones out of every type of material you could think of, and none of them sound like a stone. So in the end we said, okay, we'll risk it. I'm going to throw a real large piece of concrete at Hilton's head.
Hilton McRae.
Yeah, and every time it happens there's a bit of me that thinks, please God especially, actually, he's broke his collarbone recently. Please God, don't let me hit him. And I do go way off, I hope. I'm touching wood now, because it really scares me. So the idea of doing a whole banquet with 40 stones being chucked at various members of the company fills me with absolute horror.
There is obviously
a much more important political reason, which I don't know. I don't know why it was Nick's idea. He just said... I mean, I did fight for stones for a bit, because I thought it was sort of purer, literally, that there was something elegant about it. But I
yes,
think
Pooh isn't elegant.
Pooh isn't elegant. But I think in the end, Nick felt that his anger was so incandescent at that point that elegance was perhaps not what was needed. And, you know, I read a marvellous, this is a complete parenthesis, but the poo comes on in covered dishes, and that's in the script, you know, all covered dishes, how marvellous. And in the original, of course, they, Timon says, uncover dogs and lap. And they take off the covered dishes, and there are the stones, and Narco says the shit. But I read a lovely footnote in one edition which said in Germany, I think in the 19th century, because of a mistranslation, or rather a sort of mispunctuation, when he said uncover dogs and lap, the guests took off the covers of the dishes. There were little dogs in there. I think that's heaven. So I think we should do it one day. I think we should have just little dogs, little sort of chihuahuas, tiny little dogs, uncover dogs and lap. There you go.
It's the Globe did a production a few years ago, and their Timon and
Simon Paisley Day
did actually sit in Pooh in the second half and to think through some of it with the audience.
Yes, he was my Horatio in Hamlet, and understudied in Hamlet. Yeah.
Oh right.
Apparently, does a very 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 fierce. He's a very good mimic, Simon Paisley Day. He apparently does a very fearsome imitation of me, and of course you always think you're sort of basically inimitable, don't you? And he's refused to do it in front of me, I think, because he said he's learned that you don't do your imitations of people in front of them because they get very hurt. Anyway, yes, the sitting it's quite an interesting choice because he's right in the sense that it is deliberately self-degrading, and pastiche is the wrong word, isn't it? But it's a comment on the tradition of retreating from the world, the desert fathers, Anchorites, the Simon Stylites, all that, in the cave, communing with God and having that type of asceticism. It's a pastiche of that, isn't it? It's a take on that, which is to do with self-degradation, and I think he definitely... Mm. It makes perfect sense to sit in his own shit, I think. Mm. But I don't.
No.
God knows what's happening under those trousers, but I don't. You can't see it.
No, well, you certainly do look pretty down at heel.
Yes, I mean, we worked out... I mean,
trolley and the beanie hat.
It's been about 8 weeks, I've decided.
Right.
So
he's out on the streets.
Yeah, so he's not dying yet, but he's pretty desperate.
Desperate, yes. Yeah, we should say something about Tim Hatley's design, because it's so gloriously elegant in the first half. Yeah. But when the audience comes in, they actually see the tents, as it were, the Occupy London tents.
And the play, you see them milling around the Occupy London tents, and then the play starts with the rich people, led by Timon,
who come in front of it,
ignore it. Yeah. Yes, and I think that's rather elegant. And then in comes a sort of a drop, which is the gallery, which the Timon ring. And from then onwards, that drop remains there, and turns into a banker's office. An office in Westminster.
Yeah, it's a very clever name for the banker.
Yes, yes, Lucullus. Was it Lucullus Capital, isn't it?
Yes.
and so that stays there right the way through the first banquet and the ship banquet, and then flies out for... It's a very interesting structured part, actually, Timon, because he says very, very little in the first half. But then at the end of the first half, in our version, he has this amazingly... aggressive speech, which is the first time really that we've heard him speak at any length. You know, that and the banquet at which he serves the poo. From that point, right at the end of the first half, he finds a voice. But actually, up until then, he's sort of rather ineffectual as a speaker, isn't he? I mean, he just
money talks literally.
Yes, money literally talks, and everyone else does all the work. But yes, so it flies out this flat in four. time this great curse against Athens and the end of the first half. The second half, I'd always imagined, I had various ideas. Tim and Nick and I met before Tim started designing it. And my original idea, I had an image of the whole of the second half being water. That and I wanted to disappear into the water at the end, because the water seemed to be so important. The sound of... We still have that. We don't have water on the stage, but we do have the sound of the sea and the sound of the gulls and the sound of... And, of course, when it was set in London, I imagined it right there. I'm sitting here looking over at the city, but beyond the city at some unfinished building. Right by the river, you know, with that, and where the river is at its greyest.
Docklands, somewhere.
Yes, beyond Docklands.
Beyond Docklands, you know, yeah. That's too glorious now, isn't it?
Yeah, too smart.
Too glamorous.
But yes, beyond Docklands. I suppose Stratford, near the Olympic site, I suppose, but yes, and around there, an unfinished building. But the original idea of the sea being blue is in my head, is now, I have an absolute image of it, and just as beautiful in a way. Grey, the grey. Estuary, the Thames Estuary, grey. But somehow, for the time, they're very comforting. But so, anyway, there's this unfinished building site, which, of course, is a comment of on financial risk
yes,
as well.
Yes. And when you go off stage, are you still timing in your head? Are you imagining that you're going off into the water as you go into the...
Yes, I do, actually. Yes, once I get on the wings, I'm
ready
for a beer. But yes, no, he's walking off into the sea. And then we have that very strange end. Very strange end to the play. Where Alcibiades is...
Yes, so the establishment...
sort of suck Alcibiades in, don't they? And he puts on a suit and starts negotiating. And that awful thing, when somebody says, oh, Timon's dead, is, oh, really? Again, that sort of the person, the man has just disappeared. He's of no relevance now.
Yeah.
This hasn't been for a long time. So.
Yeah.
So his death is barely marked. You know? And it's very sad.
Yes. Do you ever find playing a bleak part gets into your brain when you're not on stage? Do you get depressed by it?
Yes, I do. Funny enough, I was with my trainer, and he And I go up and down quite a lot, actually. I think, like a lot of my family, a bit depressive. And anyway, I was going through a bad patch for about 2 weeks, and he then came and saw the show. The first thing he said was, well, no wonder you're feeling lousy. And I never used to believe that. I always used to believe that I didn't take my work home with me. But years ago, I was doing Constantine the Seagull, who, of course, ends up shooting himself, and I phoned my dad up and said, oh, I don't know, I just feel a bit lousy. And he said, oh, well, if you're playing Constantine every night, well, then that's what you're going to. And it never occurred to me. And it was him who pointed it out.
Well, his is such a wasted life. That's
terrible. And there's no there's no release, is there? I mean, it's those parts that are unreleased, and time is like that. It's sort of unreleased. I didn't feel depressed doing Hamlet. You know, there was enough there for him to fly.
There's a resolution.
Yes.
There's no resolution for Timon, is there?
I don't know what it'd be like to play Lear, because there's a resolution of a type there, but whether it's satisfying. But for Constantine, nothing.
Yeah.
And for Timon, this just shutting down of a personality, I think it's very, very sad. I have had letters about from people who, you know people who've been through that. And so it obviously... Shakespeare obviously knew where Ovi spoke.
Yes,
indeed. Yeah. We sort of stripped away there.
We shouldn't end on a bleak note, because it's a terrific performance and it's a very successful production.
Yes,
too,
it is. It's been a real... I mean, Nick's such a clever man. And he has a sort of... His productions do have a bite to them, which I...
Yes.
That's an unsentimental bite.
Yes. And I don't know, this just works, because you just think, oh my goodness, it must have been written now.
Somebody would say this line, I look at the painter and go, oh, I like your work. And yes. That's for fun of the line that's been picked up as being, "I can't be real, can it?" Yeah, I said, "Oh, no, it's absolutely there." Yeah. Oh, yeah. I like her work. Try Brit art artist in our version.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Simon.
Pleasure.
Brilliant.